Let's roll. Let's roll. And then in the future, guys, we will figure out about this back and forth. Apologies, apologies. All right. So, first things first, we are here for the Search and Seizure show. Now, I've got a list of questions that have been submitted to us, but I do not want to answer those if I have questions from people in the class that are presently here that want to get their questions answered. So, first things first, who had a question for me? We already had a question. And
Matthew, I think, right?
Matthew, yes, Matthew. I'm Matthew.
Oh, Matthew, come on, let's chat, Matthew. We don't want to test your typing
Oh,
skills.
Matthew, I don't want you to start typing. I want to allow you to speak. Unless you don't have a mic, then I want you to start typing.
Oh, there we go. I see him.
How we doing, guys? Can you hear me?
Hey, we hear
Awesome. No, so our question kind of came up. So I'm in the panhandle of Idaho, so we deal a lot with like Spokane and people coming over to Idaho, committing crime and so forth. But our
Okay.
kind of question that came up recently was, if we have a felony crime that is committed in Washington and they come over to Idaho and there's no warrant or for their arrest or any fresh pursuit, are we allowed to arrest based on the felony crime that happened in a different state? And then on top of that, kind of a second question, same thing with the Terry stop. If a crime happens or is about to happen or had occurred in Washington and they came over to Idaho, can we conduct a Terry stop based on that?
Thoughts.
That's great question.
Good question. I think I initially I'm kind of thinking there's kind of two responses to that. So I'm going to talk about the first one a little bit first. So crime committed in Spokane, and we all know how those Spokane people are, right? AB. So if the crime's committed there in their state jurisdiction, and they are now in your state, you said no pursuit issues, no arrest warrant or anything, that just the PC exists. My initial thought is that we don't have the authority over there unless you've got somebody maybe on a task force that has multi-state jurisdiction to effectuate that, or is kind of my initial thought. What do you think, John? That's kind of where my brain goes on that first part of that.
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, we're talking about I'm a state certified peace officer, at least, right? Or I was. And so my authority is in the state of Arizona. And so there is no warrant in place. I'm not going to be able to affect, I'm not going to be able to enforce the law in another state.
So I was on a DA task force for a while, and I had Fed creds. So we would go to California or the great state of Arizona, right, John? And I had the arrest powers when I was deputized, so it carried over there. But then, kind of going into your second part of that question, now, do you've got reasonable suspicion of a crime taking place over there and bleeding over into your state? I don't know if that falls in the same line, or if RS is RS, or is that kind of contradicting our first answer? No, that's kind of a good thought process here. Is
Yeah,
that
and
Paul got more on that?
kind of where the question comes from. So the question comes from the felony is from a custodial kidnapping, right? That's kind of where that question stems from.
Well, I think kidnapping is going to change the game a little bit. There's going to be exigencies, urgencies going on there, right?
Right. Well, and the kids are the victims, right? So we take care of the kids first. But the question remains, do we have the arrest powers, right? So obviously we can take care of the kids and do what we need to do with health and welfare to make sure they're safe.
Right, for
And
sure.
then the Terry stop comes from, like, okay, if they're driving on the main corridor, I-90, and then there's a hit and run at mile marker 298, and then they come into Idaho and now they're at mile post one, and WSP asks us to conduct a hit and run investigation, right? Do we have the ability to, seize those people on a traffic stop based on what happened in Washington on a hit and run for an investigation?
Looks like Paul. You're saying Rick, Paul's got some good insight on that? I'm reading Paul's comment here real quick here. Confirmed. Justice. So essentially, Paul, you're saying treat him like a fugitive, huh? In that capability, that I say. It's a really kind of a good question. I'm a yeah, can you add Paul? Oh, Paul, there you go. What do you got for us, Paul?
All right, is this working?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the PC and all charges need to come from the originating state, but if Washington says they have probable cause and they are filing warrants, they basically, you do the NCIC hit confirmation, everything you would with a normal fugitive from justice, and if the person doesn't want to go back to Washington, you house them on the fugitive from justice based on whatever probable cause from Washington. But
that's the custodial aspect in another state, fugitive.
Yeah, the fugitive from justice in Idaho works as basically a civil hold. So it's just confirming that they have extradition to another state, and the person can either waive it and go back to Washington, or right. They can fight it. They fight it and they'll get held on a governor's warrant. They don't get credit for their time or anything, and then a judge will tell them they have to go back. But yeah, as long as Washington is going to file charges, you're good to go to the Idaho side, and then you would simply, you're not booking them on the originating offense, you're booking them
right. Okay, that makes sense, because as long as they're in communication with each other, explain what Washington wants, what's going on both sides of it. That makes sense. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I think we're talking about a lot of different fact patterns here, right? Yeah. First things first, if we're talking about the kidnapping, right? And so if they're actively committing a crime, and so let's say hypothetically, I go and I kidnap my kids from my ex, right? I don't have legal authority to them. I've lost my parental rights. And so I kidnap my kids, or I custodially interfere with them because I'm not trying to hurt them, right? Per my state's legal definition. And so I take those kids and I go to another state. Now, am I actively committing a crime when I'm in that new state? Yes, right? I kidnap my ex in Arizona and I drive into California with her. I'm now violating California law. And so in that situation, I think it's not a matter of, oh, I committed the original, I kidnapped her in Arizona and drove her into California. Well, I'm still kidnapping her in California. And so you're absolutely able to enforce California law in California, even if the crime originated in another state. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Cool.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a funny question. Funny question. Yeah,
makes sense. All those, it's like in those Spokane people up there, problems. Right, Rick?
Yeah. I love the comment. I would definitely go into Washington to commit a crime. Yes, as would I. As would I.
Uh-huh. What about anybody else? Want to hop on the line, chat with us, or we want to start rolling some questions? What we got? Oh, Thomas got one.
Thomas.
We've got Matthew and Paul on here too, so.
All right, y'all hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. So I had a question on your thoughts with the recent case law in Idaho that extends the Clark ruling. It's called, I think, the State of Idaho versus Bell. Bell versus State of Idaho. Have y'all heard of that one?
Hey, yeah, because you emailed us about it, right, Thomas?
Yes.
Yes, I read that case a little bit, and So help us out on that. Give us some more detail on that one.
Yeah, so for those that aren't aware, give a little bit of background. The Clark ruling happened like 3 years ago or so, where it said, hey, in the state of Idaho, a police officer can no longer make an arrest for a misdemeanor that's committed outside of their presence. In the Idaho statute, there was always an exception for like five different crimes. For example, like assault, domestic violence stuff, DUIs, etc. Clark ruling took that away. So then back in 2019, we had an Idaho Supreme Court ruling on a case from 2019 that extends the Clark ruling, saying that if an officer does not witness the crime, they cannot arrest for it, even if the information was passed on to them from another officer. So the good example they give here,
collective knowledge doctrine, essentially, right?
Yeah, it almost challenges the collective knowledge doctrine. And that's what was in the dissent, saying this is challenging collective knowledge. We should be careful. Mm-hmm. But essentially now it's saying, like, if I was on a DUI and I called a specific officer over who does DUI investigations if I leave that scene and that officer determines this person was drunk and they decide to arrest them, they can't. They can only give them a citation because they didn't witness that person drive.
But the other officer did.
Correct.
And that was kind of the case.
If he's not there, he can't make that arrest.
That's kind of how that case unfolded, right? There was an off-duty cop, saw a guy believed to be intoxicated, got in his car, but then went to work and then relayed that information to an on-duty cop who saw or encountered him at home or something. Does that sound about right? I think kind of the details of that.
Yeah, off-duty officer, actually in our neck of the woods, off-duty officer saw a guy who was obviously intoxicated, get in his car, drive away, reported it to dispatch, also told the officer, his training officer at the time, just called him on the phone. His training officer got dispatched, went to the guy's house, saw the car there, felt it, said it was warm, knocked on the door. A minor kid answered the door and said, "Hey, yeah, my dad drove the car and we were just at the grocery store." Asked the guy to step outside, ran him through FSTs and arrested him. Now, look, that was a bad arrest in my opinion, but the case made it even worse.
Mm-hmm. But well, first of all, there's a parenting thing here. If you're a prolific driver of vehicles when you're drunk, you better coach your kids and say, "Daddy's been home all day watching football on the couch," right? So there's point number one in parenting. So I think that case kind of thing, that the arresting officer didn't see the DUI crime committed. He was home, but he still established through whatever, you know, the investigation and made that arrest. So when you start talking about that horizontal, collective knowledge, I don't know. I still feel like we as officers can convey information that we see and can attest to that and tell our partners about it and they can take action on that.
Yeah.
And so was that the crux of it? Was they were just really saying that we can't as officers, that horizontal and vertical? I'll talk about that for 2 seconds here. Vertical collective knowledge. Hey, I've got armed and dangerous. I know that I could pat this person down, but I've got stuff going on. I said, "Hey, John, pat that person down for me." You know, that's vertical collective knowledge. I know John doesn't know at the time, but I say, "Hey, go do it. Can John go do it?" Yeah. Or like there's a horizontal collective knowledge thing we talk about where, you know, people are working on similar cases or some stuff's going on, but there's communication going on with each other. You know, there's similar investigations and we're both kind of, we're talking with each other and that information can be shared. So I think challenging that is significant. I don't know.
Yeah, I think what we're worried about is that, like, for some officers who don't do DUI investigations, if they get called away to go do something else and then another officer completes the investigation, they can't do an arrest. I know a warrantless arrest to be specific, but in our county jurisdiction, we don't have MDTs, so we're not going to be able to get a warrant without like going down to the courthouse, getting a judge to meet us there. It's not feasible. Yeah.
And it's like that originating officer, you know, doing an officer's report, you know, putting in their, you know, their accounts and what they saw and making that part of the arrest, or is that being, you know, accounted for in the arrest report?
Yeah. They would do a sup to say, you know, "I made the stop and here was the PC for the stop," for example.
Interesting.
But they say, like, the way it's written is, or the way they're the prosecuting attorney is telling us now, is you have to be on site for the arrest, preferably the person that makes the arrest if you're the one that witnessed it.
So I mean, that's the solution, right? Is now all of a sudden we don't really have this collective doctrine. Whatever officer's involved in the stop, they observe the driving. If they get a DUI specific officer there, cool. Well, then I'm just going to hang out right there with him and then wait for him to do his investigation. And then I'm going to arrest the guy, right? Because I was the one who observed the misdemeanor being committed in my presence. This is a weird case, right? It's a weird case. It complicates things. There's a whole lot going on. I'm just wondering, Thomas, right? And Mike, maybe you can weigh in on this. So basically what we have here is we have an off-duty officer, this Officer Palace, right? Mm-hmm. And he calls in and he says, "Hey, I saw this dude walk out of Albertsons and he looks like he's drunk. I don't see any driving as Officer Palace. All I see is his walking out to the car." Okay. Then the training officer responds and They don't find the vehicle in motion, but they go to the house. Vehicle's there. He touches the hood. It's warm. I'm fine with that under Jones because we got exigency, right? So search, but the effervescent nature of the evidence. So I'm good with that as far as a search goes. So I go up and I make contact with my suspect. Kid confirms, yeah, he's drunk and he was driving, or at least he was driving. I make contact with my suspect. I ask him to step outside. We have this conversation. And then he says, you know, yeah, I had five drinks earlier and I drove, right? And I have in the opinion, he actually says, and I haven't drank since I've been home. So whatever level of intoxication I have now, I had when I was just driving. And so now I can't, as this officer, I can't make this warrantless arrest because of the crime did not occur in my presence. So what do I do with this guy? Because I need to take him and I need to have him submit to to breathalyzer, right? Or draw his blood.
But yeah, I mean, it's not so much of a problem for us because we have the life lock, the mobile life lock, and that's admissible in court in the state of Idaho. So I don't have to take them back to the station to do anything. In that situation, I would have gathered breath myself and then just wrote him a citation.
Okay. But I mean, so think about Thomas, he says no. He says, I'm not going to walk over to your car and blow into your machine.
I think at that point, to be honest, that would be over my head. I would call the on-call prosecutor and just see if we need to get a blood warrant at that point. Because that's kind of like a refusal, right? Like, what am I going to do next? I'd probably get a blood warrant from a judge.
Yeah.
So I'd have to have an officer sit on the house with the dude while we go get this process going.
Right.
Yeah. Matthew's got more information on that.
Yeah, I mean, mostly what this case truly affects too is like FTOs and trainees, right? Because getting them on scene to do the investigation for a DUI that did not happen in their presence, that's where it's really affecting us. But training at the end of it, what was that?
The training aspect of it, like, hey, I haven't done DUI yet. Hey, yep. call your trainee over here to do. Okay.
Yeah, trainees, and then actually going through the arrest. But on top of that, I mean, this case was it doesn't go against the Fourth Amendment. It goes against the Idaho Constitution. That's what this case was filed on, which was the same thing as the Clark ruling. So, because Idaho's, you know, it's, I would say, more strict than the Fourth Amendment by far. So this case ruling is really against the Idaho Constitution. I mean, at the end of the day, right, the Clark ruling, if a misdemeanor was not committed in your presence, you cannot arrest for it. You can still do a citizen's arrest, but you cannot be the one doing the arrest. So with this, the off-duty officer that was not there at the scene and did not arrest the suspect, right, this just created a huge crap show for this ruling. So, I mean, pretty much it's just for DUIs, if it was committed in your presence, you have to be the one to pretty much say you're under arrest, right? So it's not against the Fourth Amendment, just the Idaho Constitution. So it's not going to go, I don't believe it's going to go to the Supreme Court because it stops at the appellate level with the Constitution.
Right. What about domestic violence in Idaho? That's usually a misdemeanor not committed in your presence. You guys have arrest power written into statute for that?
Nope. We have to, depending on your agency, we have to, you have to get an arrest warrant in order to effectuate that arrest. But depending on your agency, and it, you can get it pretty quickly. But, you know, with smaller agencies in Idaho, just like the other guy said, right, they don't have MDCs. They have to actually go down to the court or wake up a judge and go to their house to get that arrest warrant signed.
To make a misdemeanor battery domestic violence arrest.
Yes. Yep. Not do it unless the victim wants to do a citizen's arrest.
Well, that's not good for anybody.
Right. And absolutely. So yeah, it's, you know, the Clark ruling was very tough. The Bell ruling's even more tough, but you know, at the end of the day, it is what it is.
And yeah, and that leads to like really not questionable, but it leads to us trying to get around the law to make an arrest sometimes, especially in smaller agencies.
Thomas, what are you saying? You're saying cops trying to work around the law. What are you saying here?
No, let me explain, right? Just as lawyers use the law and the words of the law, cops do the same thing, right? I think
we're creative as hell, aren't we?
When it talks about like, you know, in the case of domestic violence in Idaho, it can be a felony, right? Depending on the level that the person was beat, traumatic injury can be internal injuries that you can't see. So you could charge him with a felony if you could articulate somehow that it was traumatic.
Creativity, right? There you go. Articulation.
Yeah. But I get nervous doing stuff like that, though. It's not a good practice because you could end up with more case law, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got to be genuine. You've got to truly believe that, you know, you got to make sure.
Of course. Yeah.
Sounds to me like you guys just need to decide who's going to be the agreed upon citizen tonight. You take off your vest, you take off your gun, and you come in and affect that citizen arrest. Understand, I'm not in my role of a police officer right now. I don't know. Asinine.
Well, thank you all. Hopefully that helps a little bit, Thomas. And thank you, Matthew, again.
Thanks.
All right. That's good stuff. I like when everybody's in this. It's fun. Right. Yeah, John, you answered that. You asked that question about touching the hood. Yeah, it's search, but you explained why, right? There's some exigencies there, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. If we got more questions about it, we can certainly ask that. That is a lot of, I mean, Utah versus Spites is the case there for that. But yeah, I don't know. That's an emerging thing too.
All right. Anybody else want to chat with us? I think. Do we have any prize money out tonight, Rick?
Mike's the blue to gold Santa. He just starts handing out merch.
Right. You get this and you get this. All right, you want to jump into an email question, John?
We'll jump into an email question. So the question is this. I know officers can ask for ID of passengers as long as it doesn't prolong the stop, but generally cannot legally demand it. Does the smell... So in states where marijuana is still illegal, is the smell of... burned or otherwise marijuana reasonable suspicion to demand ID of everyone in the vehicle? And so the question here is, you pull over a vehicle, you got the smell of marijuana coming from the car, burnt or otherwise, marijuana is illegal in your state, can you demand ID from everybody in the car? And the question that I would have is are you in a stop and ID state?
Yeah, good point there. Most are. There's a few outliers there, right? He says from Virginia. I'd have to look on that one. But I think when it boils down to it is if it is stop and identify, and it comes down to do you have reasonable suspicion that everybody in that car is involved in the crime that's illegal. Like, say if the marijuana is still legal, wherever that is, I'd like to move. It's Cheech and Chong driving down the street, which some of you younger cops on here might not know who that is, but comedy dudes that just smoked marijuana constantly. Their car was full of smoke and it just billowed out of the car. Well, you can articulate pretty easily that everybody in that car is involved with what's going on. Or if it's not burnt and if it's that smell of fresh, well, that's a pretty pungent, recognizable smell too. Just draw the lines. Hey, everybody in this car, you know, based on the smell, should know what it is. You know, do you have RS to demand ID? Yes. If you don't have RS, then ask. But just be like I said, like the question said, be careful about extending the stop. Again, if it starts out as a traffic stop, we'll stay on that mission as a traffic stop.
And I mean, you're getting a new ice cube, right? We talked about that. You're getting a new ice cube if you've got reasonable suspicion to believe that there is marijuana inside that vehicle. If you've got plain smell, then you got PC to believe that marijuana is inside the vehicle. And so, yeah, everybody is detained at that point. But in, you know, there's only 23 states that are stop and ID states where you are legally required to identify yourself. You are
the higher paid,
right? Where is this person from, Mike?
It says Virginia. So only Virginia. 23. I thought that would be a higher number.
Yeah, Virginia is not a stop and ID state. Yep. So now you can, you know, I always, when I teach in stop and non-stop and ID states, right? Arizona was, so I struggle with that concept. But when I teach in non-stop and ID states, like the state of Texas is not a stop and ID state. When I teach in those states, I say, well, you know, it makes things harder because legally, can I require someone to identify themselves? No, but at the same time, can I detain them for a much longer time and have it be reasonable? And the answer is yes, because if they're refusing to identify themselves to me, well, then that's going to have a significant impact on the length of my investigation. Versus if I have successfully identified them, well, then it's a lot easier for me to let them go. Because why? If my investigation continues and ultimately I determine whatever the crime is, they were involved, well, then I've got follow-up. I can submit paperwork. I can submit charges, get a warrant, things of that nature, right? So.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Paul says, pull them out of the car, see if the smell is on their person or if there's some other kind of nexus, right?
Oh, nexus. You know, we like that word, Paul.
There you go. Right. Yeah.
And I think maybe what Paul's getting at there too is, can you, let's say you've got PC to search that car, can you automatically search the occupants of that car? And it's not automatic. We don't like that word. But what Paul's keying in here on a nexus, there's something that, you know, gives you individualized PC for that person. So yeah, I like it, Paul.
Beautiful. All right.
Anybody else on the hotline? Matthew, probable cause for frequenting Idaho. I hear it's a nice state. I like to, I haven't been up there very much. I got to check it out someday.
All right. Question is this. Can a person in custody who has been read Miranda give consent to search their cell phone, vehicle, and or residence? What do you think, Mike? Is the fact that they are in custority remove
in
their
custody authority and consent? Huh? Well, the short answer is yes, they can. But we got to be careful, right? We got to be careful because you're asking, right? It's boiling down to consent. Now, is being in custody and handcuffed or in the backseat of a patrol car, is that a pretty coercive environment? Yeah, I'd say so. We can overcome that, and there's a bunch of ways we can do that. But really, it's like you gotta convince the course that is voluntary. You know, we've got to stay away from the coercive environment. You don't want to have 10 cops standing around there, their hands on their guns, saying, "Hey, can I search your car? Can I search your house?" You know, in a real dominating environment. Do you want to, you know, you want to yell at them? And the way we speak with people, conversational tone goes a long way, and that's something that's important too in our documentation of our paperwork. You know, when the subject was in handcuffs and in the backseat of the car, and I spoke with them in a conversational tone, explain that when you are trying to paint this picture that it was voluntary for them to still say yes in doing so. And I think was part of the question too, talking about you know, can we do so? And bottom line is, yeah, we can. For sure.
Yep.
One of the big things that's not always a must, and I don't teach it as a must, but it's an option in a scenario like this where somebody is in that, you know, that dominated environment in handcuffs, where you're really trying to show this voluntary aspect. And again, it's not something that you should do every time, but give them that option to refuse you. Say, you don't have to give me consent. You have the right to refuse, but I'm asking you if I could search your car. So when you throw that out there in this circumstance, I think that goes a long way in overcoming that coercive environment, showing the voluntary component to that.
Yep, right. Telling them you can say no. It's hard for them to make the argument that, you know, I was coerced when the officer actually told me you can say no. Yeah. United States versus Watson is the Supreme Court case. Guys in handcuffs in the backseat of a car, Still, he was able to give consent to search his vehicle because the officer, largely in part because the officer told him, you don't have to say yes, you can tell me no. Now, the question is, can somebody who's under arrest give you consent to search their house? Remember, consent can be denied, can be revoked at any time, right? And so if you are going to, you know, somebody who's handcuffed in the backseat of a car, arrested, rely on their consent to search their house, you need to establish some kind of line of communication if you're going to be going that far, so that if they decide that they no longer want you to let them search, or no longer want to let you search, then they can tell you no, and they're not just screaming in the backseat of a police car outside while you're searching your heart's content.
Absolutely. Yeah. Establish that line of communication. Something that I think the courts even spoke about too is, if safe to do so, if you can put them in a position where they can oversee the search taking place, cars easier than a house, then, you know, that plays into that voluntary, that consent as well. They saw the search taking place. They didn't make any verbal statements to stop what we were doing. So all those things, if it's, if safe to do so and applicable, articulated.
Okay. All right, guys, we're going to have one more question and then we're going to wrap this bad boy up, because I go to bed. And the question is, let's see, TJ, what do you got, man?
TJ there?
I don't know if TJ is able to talk. He might not be. He typed the question. So if he can't tell me, we'll just read it.
I'm reading here.
Oh, TJ is getting his coat. He's bringing in reinforcements.
What?
Oh, he's scared. Tell him he doesn't need to be scared. We're gentle.
Well, it's not my case. I'm getting my coworker. He's like, hey, Bob, come here for a second. Bob's like, what? He's like, hey, you're on the live show right now. Talk search and seizure. It's cool, though. Tell everybody about your case.
We are actively investigating this. All right. So he says, I don't know if I got a mic. So here's the question, guys. He said, DWI arrest is made. Arrestee removed from the scene and is processed. After dealing with the driver, can the arresting officer return and search the vehicle for elements of the DWI crime? Okay. All right.
I'm listening.
There's a lot going on here. So your question doesn't tell us, what did we do with the car?
Let's see here. I'm trying to read the question. Sorry. My thing keeps blanking out here.
All right. Legally parked roadside, we have keys. So here's what I'll tell you, right? So I got DUI, I pull this guy over, I get him out, it legally parks, I pull him out, we go through this thing. Ultimately, I arrest him for DUI, then I transport him, I process him, I do whatever I do with him, then I return back to the vehicle and search it. You're going to be in a lot of trouble, because a defense attorney is going to have a field day with that. What happened to that car while you were gone? Right? Who else has access to it? Anything that you find in that vehicle, I'm going to make the argument it wasn't in there when you stopped my client, and it was in, somebody else put it in there. You can't say they didn't, right? I don't know. So I think better practice is, I pull over this DUI driver, right? I make the contact with him. We tow the vehicle back to our secured lot. I process the guy. And the question is, can I then search that vehicle without a warrant? Well, first off, you're going to have to ask what legal theory are you operating under? If you're operating under the Carroll Doctrine, well, then you've got to convince me that you have probable cause to be, there's evidence of a crime inside that vehicle. And that's not a hard standard necessarily. It's a fair probability to believe that evidence of DUI is inside that vehicle. And so what could you be looking for? Open containers, empty containers, receipts that say when they bought booze at a bar, how much, right? Okay, cool. Chambers versus Maroney is the case that says, if you've got PC on the side of the road and you can search the vehicle out subject to the automobile exception, then if we transport the vehicle or tow the vehicle back to a secured lot, well, the automobile exception still applies because of the reduced expectation of privacy in the vehicle. Now, your policy may be more restrictive, right? Mine was. Mine says if we tow a vehicle from a scene back to a secured lot, we'll get a warrant. No reason not to get a warrant in that case. There is no exigency, but per the letter of the law, you are not required. Now, if you are on scene and you are conducting your investigation and another officer is there and you develop that PC for his arrest, the other officer can then go up to that vehicle and search that vehicle incident to arrest, as long as the subject is out of handcuffs and within reaching distance of the vehicle. Now, I don't teach that. That's a horrible, horrible practice. Don't ever do it. So if you want to rely on Arizona versus Gant, you're going to need to convince me that you have reason to believe that there is evidence of the crime of arrest inside that vehicle. However, I would suggest that you do that search on scene, not come back later to the vehicle, because that's adding a whole nother element to the court's holding in Gant, and it's not going to work out well for you.
Hey, John, I want to touch on one thing. Geez, I can't see who put it in. Someone talked about the inventory component to that. So if your statute or your policy says if you make an arrest for a DUI, you will or shall tow that car and inventory, there's no decision in it, that's fine. Do your thing. But if there is any ability for you to decide tow or not tow, just make sure that whenever you do an inventory for DUI or for anything, make sure that you are not using the inventory to work around the Fourth Amendment to get into that car for evidence type searches. Okay. If, say, you don't have a PC or you don't have Gant, you don't have any way to get inside that car, no consent. You know, think about our crew acronym that we talk about here. And you're like, well, you know, I could just inventory it, even though you normally would. The courts will see through that. So just be very careful in trying to get into cars for evidence under inventory. It's not going to work. All right.
Rock and roll. All right, guys. If you guys do have any other questions for us, bluetogold.com/show, bluetogold.com/show. Submit your questions. And we would love to either make a YouTube video out of them or pull them in and use them in the Search and Seizure show the next time we do it with our next free webinar. There is the link right there. Richard's on it. Richard's on it. All right, Mike, you got any final thoughts, any words of wisdom to leave us with?
Thanks, everybody. It's always a pleasure hearing from you all, and we enjoy getting the questions. So spread the word, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Keep doing the good work out there. God bless you guys. Be safe.